You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday. This rainy Tuesday, at least where I am, February 7th, 2017. My pleasure to be with you here in just a little bit. We'll be talking to Alyssa Wilkinson, Alyssa, who is a quarterly guest on the program. Alyssa, who is a film critic. Most recently, she writes for the online magazine Vox. Really one of my favorite, if not my favorite, film critic. She's an evangelical with a Catholic sensibility. Writes for Vox. She's written for Rolling Stone, for Christianity Today. Quite a diverse variety of media outlets, but brings the same great sensibility and what I would call Catholic imagination to her film work. She's also Associate Professor of English and Humanities at the King's College, which is an evangelical school in New York City, and I look forward to having Alyssa on this morning. Of course, I may have to get her commentary on the upcoming Oscars and whether 2016 is, as I sort of suspect, is one of the great years in recent memory for film. But I also want to ask her about how her work as a professor with students, particularly in English and the humanities, I think I'm trying to think of what the courses are that she teaches. She teaches a creative writing course. She teaches a humanities. We'll talk about that. We'll find out what she teaches and how her work. She teaches criticism, postmodern theory, and cultural anthropology. I'd like to know how her work in those fields as a critic and a professor inform each other. Because part of the whole understanding, the Christian understanding of the person, is we are a totality, right? So we're not compartmentalized. Each role that we play or have interfaces with the other. So look forward to that conversation with Alyssa a little bit later in the program. We'll talk about some other things as well. A helpful Lenten prepper is coming sooner than you think, and compassion and conviction on the gender controversies. We may also revisit the Super Bowl just a little bit. Yeah, Falcons, another day. I'm sure you feel better. Well, maybe maybe not. That's going to take a long time to get over. If you want to give me a shout anytime during the program today, you'd be welcome to. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4 is the number to call or text. You can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com, or you can post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter. My question of the day today is Garth Brooks' 55th birthday. Wow, it seems like he should be older than that for some reason. I mean, I guess he was, huge in the late 80s when he was just a youngin. Then he kind of went on hiatus for a while. He's come back just a little bit. I still prefer old Garth. The stuff, but before he started incorporating church choirs into his music. So my question of the day is, what's your favorite Garth Brooks song? 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. As I said, call or text, email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com, or post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter. Some of you have already done that. Mike Allen Show, the handle. I'll share some of those a little bit later in the program. I've already been into it a little bit on Facebook this morning. When you get tagged by somebody, and I got tagged on an issue about Islam and immigration and vetting, and for some reason I guess given this impression, and if perception's reality, I guess it's my fault, but given this impression that I don't believe in any vetting or whatever, just hey, come on in. That's never been my perspective. But at the same time, I think there's a great mythology in terms of how much vetting is done, and I think there's a lot of fear stoking going on right now about the other. And conveniently enough, the other tends to have, either a different faith than I have or a different pigment of skin, typically. Again, I'm not saying that in my exchange this morning. I'm just saying I think there is a fear mongering that's going on, led, I think, by our commander in chief, quite frankly, that is not helpful. So anyway, 5734BREAD4, if you want to disagree, you certainly can. I've been thinking about this issue here, and I want to talk about this primarily here in this segment. It's interesting when what I'm doing in the classroom with my senior New Testament class and what happens in the Sunday liturgy in terms of lectionary readings. You know, the church has her scheduled readings for particular Sundays, every day in which Mass is celebrated throughout the liturgical year. And there's this interesting sort of confluence going on right now in that I'm just now, I've moved with my senior class into the Gospel of Matthew. We covered the Gospel of Mark, which I like because, I mean, I like all the Gospels, of course, but good intro because they can read it in its completion. It's the shortest Gospel. It's very action-packed. But now we've gone over into Matthew's Gospel. My goal is to get through all four of the Gospels and a little bit more before spring break in early April because they're seniors. Come on. But anyway, so now we've gotten into Matthew and we're understanding Matthew from the perspective of many scholars and those who have observed Matthew. Matthew primarily oriented as a gospel for Jewish Christians and laid out very catechetically with Jesus in five primary teaching discourses, extended discourses, the longest of which, of course, is what we're talking about right now and what we're reading in the Sunday Masses last Sunday and the next three ahead from the Sermon on the Mount, which really, if the primary emphasis of Jesus' teaching, his proclamation, was the kingdom of God. This is what his parables are about. This was in the Gospels, what he came forth preaching. The kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe the gospel. Then the Sermon on the Mount, in many ways, encapsulates and casts a vision of what this kingdom is about, what its ethos is, what its basic and fundamental principles and values are. And as we saw last Sunday in the Beatitudes, and I actually just wrote a column about this for our diocesan newspaper, the Blessed Ours, in which Jesus turns completely on its head many of our cultural presuppositions about what leads to the happy life. Our culture would tell us, both within and without the church oftentimes, that the truly happy, the admirable one, the one that we would consider to be fortunate, are not the poor in spirit or the mournful or the meek. They're the rich. They're the powerful. They're the famous. They're the talented. They're the beautiful. Jesus turns all that on its ear. And then he gets into this whole series of deepening our understanding of the law of Moses. I mean, Jesus makes very clear in Matthew 5:17, don't think I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. I've not come to abolish, but I've come to fulfill. And he goes on with these, you have heard that it was said, but I say to you, right? And usually after the you have heard that it was said, it's some Mosaic law or some Old Testament principle from the Pentateuch. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery, for example, the commandments. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And then he says, but I say to you. Now, if we didn't know Matthew 5:17, and this is why it's so important to interpret Scripture by Scripture. If we didn't know what Jesus said in Matthew 5:17, I've not come to abolish it, to fulfill it, we might think that but is like, as we say, if you hear a but in a sentence, ignore everything that you heard before the but. You know, when somebody's trying to brace you for a criticism, they'll say, listen, man, I love you, brother, but blah, 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 blah. Or, I think you're a great guy, but let's just forget everything before the but. Well, Jesus doesn't give us that option. So he's not canceling the law of Moses. He's deepening it and strengthening it. It does away with this notion that Jesus somehow came to lighten up the demands of the law. Jesus actually takes the law of Moses deeper than anyone ever has to issues of the heart. You've heard that it was said to your ancestors, you shall not kill, and whoever kills will be liable to judgment. But I say to you, whoever is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, will be answerable to the Sanhedrin. I guess that was a particularly vicious Aramaic insult. I haven't seen that on social media lately. And whoever says, you fool, will be liable to fiery Gehenna. He also talks about not being angry with your brother and all these things. Jesus casts a vision of the ethics of the kingdom that are far beyond our what's the least I can do to be faithful mentality. And if we really take his words seriously and we strip away sort of the spirituality veneer that affects oftentimes the way we hear scripture, and we really encounter them for the radical challenges that they are, then they can leave us in a place reeling. We realize how far we are from that kingdom he came embodying. So we're going to get back into this at the bottom of the hour. When we come back from the break, I'm going to have a conversation with Alyssa Wilkinson. Alyssa, who teaches at the King's College, is a film critic for Vox. Also has her own website. Check it out, alyssawilkinson.com. We'll be back with her in just a minute. We'll also maybe talk about her Oscar viewpoints, as well as how her work as a critic and a professor interact. This is The Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, February 7th. Pleased to be joined by Alyssa Wilkinson. She's been a guest on the program before. She is Associate Professor of English and Humanities at the King's College in New York City, where she teaches criticism, postmodern theory, and cultural anthropology. She's also a staff writer at Vox.com, focusing on film. She's also been the chief film critic at Christianity Today and has written on pop culture and art for a decade at Rolling Stone, Vulture, RogerEbert.com, Books and Culture, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and the list goes on. Good morning, Alyssa.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit about the King's College for those who are not familiar with it.
Yeah, so King's has an old history. It used to be upstate New York, and then it closed down for a while in the 90s and was relocated down to New York City. And I guess we've been in the current location, well, at least in New York City, about 18 years or so. And it's a small, private, Christian, ecumenical liberal arts college. So I think we top out around 500 students right now. We have a very rigorous core curriculum in politics, philosophy, and economics, and then majors in a bunch of different areas. There is a major in politics, philosophy, and economics. But the one I teach in is called Media, Culture, and the Arts, which is a diverse, you know, kind of cross-genre major. And we have majors in English and journalism and things like that. We're little and scrappy, but rigorous and rooted in Christian conviction, but also very forward and broad-thinking, I think, in how we conceive of what we're doing as Christian educators.
Do you ever find yourself in the world you live in, you know, because obviously you're not just there at King's College, you were recently at the Sundance Film Festival, you write for Vox, which is not an evangelical publication. I mean, do you ever find yourself sort of correcting misconceptions, perhaps, on some level of how evangelicals think?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that's true on both sides. Like, whenever I'm in an evangelical world, I find myself correcting misconceptions about how evangelicals are perceived, and then vice versa, for sure. You know, the tendency is to think that evangelicals are monolithic in how they think, especially after, you know, more like recent political events. And, you know, that's never been true, but the word evangelical has never been very well defined for most people. So trying to make sense of it for people is a challenge, but I think it's fun most of the time.
I'd say every group out there that feels misunderstood cringes the most when they have one of their own confirm the stereotype, you know?
Yep. Yep, that's absolutely true. And I mean, I certainly wince, but then at the same time, I think the longer you spend being, you know, just clear about who you are and what you believe, but also willing to listen to others and affirm good wherever you see it, then people are interested and they want to know, you know, well, why do you think the way you think, and what does that mean for you, and what does that mean for your faith and for your work and all of those things. And so, you know, a lot of this is just a matter of not getting offended and upset at every turn, but just recognizing that people are people and they only know their experience. And, you know, I can become part of that experience.
Well, we oftentimes, when you've had you on before, Alyssa, we've talked about film, and certainly I don't want to steer away from that, but I want to focus a little bit more, too, on your work there at the King's College. And I'm particularly interested in how, you know, you teach criticism, postmodern theory, cultural anthropology to students at King's, most of whom I would assume are the typical college-age student. How does your work as a professor interplay with your work as a critic in terms of maybe the kind of things that you want, the way that you want, I guess, to help your students in terms of how they begin to look at and view the world?
Yeah. You know, the two things have really informed each other. So I've been teaching for 8 years now, and so a lot of my career as a critic has built up during that time. And I, you know, it's interesting because I sort of got into teaching criticism at King's because I was doing it already. And I said, oh, you know, we should have this course. This seems like it'd be a great course. And then it wound up being made part of the core curriculum for the major. And in my mind, what we do at King's is a really great preparation for a cultural critic, because critics really should have knowledge that's much broader than just, oh, what is movie history or anything like that. But you need to know things about, you know, broader history. You need to know things about theology. You need to know things about philosophy and about science and just about all these literature, all these different areas. So I thought that was a good preparation. And then I discovered that, you know, criticism is really just the art of looking at things very closely and then being able to articulate what you see very winsomely. That's all it is. It's not about passing judgment, but it's about you know, assessing things with a critical eye and seeing what other people might miss. So my goal with the students is to just help them do that. And sometimes that means that maybe big picture philosophical or religious things come into what they're writing. And sometimes it just means like learning to write a really good sentence, which is increasingly rare, I think. And so that's what I'm looking for. And then teaching them has always helped my own criticism, because you can't, you know, teachers learn the most in the classroom, and you can't really teach a subject without coming to understand it more deeply yourself. And so that's been really helpful for me. It's also helped me kind of articulate a theory of criticism for myself, and to know what I think is good and what I don't think is good, and then know how to articulate that as well, because once you're starting to grade papers, you have to be able to tell them why they got the grade they did.
Yeah, one of the things I really like about your approach as a critic, too, and this is, I would imagine this bleeds out into how you were trying to shape these students. There's a tendency, and maybe there's a tendency in certain aspects of the Christian faith, and it's not just evangelicalism, but I would say conservative Catholicism, whatever, to automatically dismiss everything from the culture as, you know, as bad, as ungodly, and so forth, But to be able to engage and to encounter and to see the good, the true, and the beautiful that's there, even if sometimes it's intermixed with things that we would have a legitimate disagreement with.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. I think that, you know, the knee-jerk reaction to dismiss something because maybe it has an element that conflicts with our deeply held beliefs or elements is pretty strong. And so we're trying to learn to overcome that in the same way that I don't want to reject a person as a person just because they don't believe the same thing that I do. I wouldn't want to do that with a work of art necessarily. And so, you know, I think the big switch for me with my students is we're trying to not think of things in terms of, does this line up with my beliefs? Does it confirm my beliefs or not? Or, you know, an alternate way of thinking about it, I think a better way is to think about how, is this thing being honest or is it being manipulative? And those are really the lines that most art fall down on. An artist, honestly, even falteringly, but honestly trying to make their way through the world and understand it, as opposed to someone who basically is making a piece of art, quote unquote, to, you know, pull money out of people's pockets. And so I think there's a big difference there. I think that there are tendencies, particularly in big Hollywood movies, to just be trying to come up with something that people will pay to see. But there are so much more to film than what Hollywood puts out. And sometimes even Hollywood gets it right. So, you know, I'm generally very hopeful about the state of movies because I see more and more of that honesty and less of that manipulation. And I, you know, I hope that continues, but I also think it's just as a result of recognizing that people are only going to come to the theater, you know, or in droves if they see something that they really resonate with in a film. And so that's what we're looking for as critics. And then I can go on and, you know, I can articulate how this is or isn't lining up with my views, but that's not really the point. So much as trying to be clear about where the artist is coming from, what the artist is trying to do.
Well, let me ask you, as we got about a minute and a half left, do you have time if I give you about five categories to give us a really quick Oscar prediction?
Sure.
All right. Best Picture.
I think it'll be La La Land.
Yeah, certainly got that.
I would love to see some other ones win, but that won't be devastating.
Lead actor.
Lead actor, mm-hmm. I think, will be Denzel Washington. I'm pretty sure. He won at the SAG Awards for Fences, and he's phenomenal, and it's his time to get that.
Boy, that is a heavy movie. Really, really well acted. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Lead actress.
You know, I'm guessing Emma Stone probably for La La Land. She's been kind of cleaning up on that. She is very good in that film, and I also feel like that film doesn't give her a lot to work with as a character, so she's just doing something pretty phenomenal there.
Supporting actor.
This is a hard category, but I think it'll be Mahershala Ali for Moonlight. He's winning everything. He's also just so great. And he's in several other movies this year, including Hidden Figures, which is usually a good guess at who's going to win.
Supporting actress.
That'll be Viola Davis. I think she has it locked up for Fences, and she's just, she's always stunning, but she's so great in that movie.
That one scene. I'm sure when I say that, you know exactly what I mean. So, and best director.
You know, I think it might be Barry Jenkins, who directed Moonlight. It could go in a number of different ways, but I think it might be him.
Alyssa, always a pleasure. You do great work.
Mm-hmm.
Check out her book, too, How to Survive the Apocalypse, Zombie Cylons, Faith and Politics at the End of the World. Blessings to you and your students.
Thank you.
All right.
Same to you.
We'll be back in just a minute with more. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. If you want to learn more about Breadbox Media, hashtag get Breadbox. Get the app to your smartphone. You can always carry Breadbox Media with you in your pocket. If you don't have a smartphone like me, I've still got the old slide phone. You'd think that maybe, I'm also using kerosene lamps. Who knows? But if you have a smartphone, get it. If not, you can just stream it online. Listen anytime you want. You can either listen live or you can listen to podcasts of the program through Google Play, iTunes, or Podbean. Check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. We have lots of different contributors, all with different personalities, temperaments, and perspectives, all through the lens of the Catholic faith. I need to, I wish Alyssa Wilkinson had a podcast because I would listen. I really appreciate her perspective. She's really, I think, my favorite film critic. I like Stephen Gray Donis a lot, the Catholic deacon. But Alyssa writes, I think, in a way that with that evangelical but Catholic sensibility at film, she sees the good, the true, and the beautiful, even in things that we might initially knee-jerk react against. And appreciate the work she does. And I would imagine the students there are being shaped and formed in a pretty significant way in the classroom. So, like I said, check out her work at alyssawilkinson.com. My question of the day, Garth Brooks, 55 years old today. What is your favorite Garth Brooks song? He was quite the thing back in the day. So let's see some of the responses we've gotten. If you want to call or text 573-4BREAD-4, email me mikeallenshow@gmail.com or post a thought on Facebook, Twitter. Kathy says, The Dance. Yeah, that's a song that's been sung at many a funeral. Looking back, all the memory of... Sorry, I won't torture you. Christy... She said, oof, that's hard. I also vote The Dance. Dana, Friends in Low Places. Now, I would imagine that his concerts, I've never been to a Garth Brooks concert. I hear they're pretty fun. He either closes with Friends in Low Places or The Dance. Now, Mary says, so many I like Shameless and The River. Also a fan of a few that were never released as singles like Bella Wood. Stephen Bullivant from over across the pond in the UK says, like the whole Chris Gaines album, especially That's the Way I Remember It. Okay, you got me curious, Stephen, because the whole Chris Gaines experiment has been pretty widely mocked. it's kind of like it's viewed the same way people view New Coke. You know, not Garth Brooks' finest moment, but I will be honest with you, I've never listened to a single Chris Gaines song, so... You saying that, and assuming you're not saying it tongue-in-cheek, I will have to check it out. Let's see, some other responses. I kind of go back and forth between my personal page and the show page because I posted the question both places. Allison says, The Dance. Daniel, either Friends in Low Places or The Dance. I need to look at this ranking of his top 25 Billboard hits. I tell you, one that's not on there. And is my favorite Garth Brooks song. And I'm going to post a link to it a little bit later, the video. It's kind of hard to find. You know, Garth doesn't do Spotify. You can't find his stuff on YouTube, typically. He's pretty particular about his copyright stuff, which it's hard to blame a guy. But there's a song that he sang after the Oklahoma City bombing called The Change. And it is... beautiful. And I'm not sure, I don't know that he wrote it. I don't even think it was necessarily written for that occasion. But it was so perfect because the whole question is, what do we do in response to grave evil? And the chorus goes something like this, and I hear you saying that you'll never change things. And no matter what you do, it's still the same thing. But it's not the world that I am changing. I do this so the world will know that it will not change me. That song, it just gives me chills. I will post a link to it. It's a great, great song. Also like Much Too Young to Feel This Damn Old. I think that was maybe his first hit He gives a little shout out to his late friend Chris Ledoux in it. Also, like Not Counting You, Never Lost in Love, Not Counting You, and Unanswered Prayers. I mean, that's a hard one to beat, too. Yeah, he's had some great ones. 5734BREAD4, you are free to chime in. 5734BREAD4, you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Interesting article in Slate.com. The greatest, saddest Super Bowl ever. The New England Patriots' amazing overtime victory was an even more amazing catastrophe for the Atlanta Falcons. I did find out that my friend, who is an Atlanta Falcons fan, really the only passionate Atlanta Falcons fan that I know, was still alive. He being a non-drinker, had not taken up the sauce, though I'm sure he was tempted. And it got me thinking a little bit, and I was talking to somebody about this yesterday. Is it worth it being a sports fan? On the whole, do the joys, rare as they are, counterbalance the excruciating, crushing disappointment? And I'll be honest with you, the older I get, the less confident I am. Now, it's too late for me. Okay, I'm hooked in sports. I'll always be hooked in sports. I'll always follow it. Maybe I've got some masochist in me. I don't know. But, you know, you kind of begin to shield yourself a little bit the older you get. Maybe you don't care quite as much because you know the pain of disappointment is so acute. And it's probably a sign of great mental imbalance on my part that I would even ask the question, oh, enjoy the sport. You know, enjoy it from the outside. You know, appreciate the game. It's sort of, I would almost make a parallel of sorts to the Catholic faith for me. I know people who are not Catholic who appreciate the Catholic faith. They're not taken by all the false caricatures of Catholicism. They have an appreciation for the beauty of the Catholic Church. They might even call themselves a Methodic or something like that. They're Methodist, but they have Catholic sensibilities and Catholic sympathies. But they remain in sort of a safe place. Their heart is not all in on the Catholic faith. They haven't made a commitment of their conviction, even with all the misunderstanding from friends and family who may not quite get why they became Catholic. They kind of keep themselves at a safe distance. Whereas the Catholic faith is really not intended to be that way. If you believe in the truth of the Catholic faith, then you are bound to enter the Catholic Church, quite frankly. You are morally bound, because truth is not something we can simply stand out from afar and admire. I guess in its own way, there are those who approach sports like that too. And that's probably not a moral crisis, like simply appreciating from the outside the Catholic faith. But you meet these people. You know, I like watching the games, but I just really don't get wrapped up in it. Or, you know, if my team wins, my team loses, well, I've not approached sports that way. It's too late for me. As a kid, I dove in, and there I am. And so, anyway, as this story says from Slate, the Golden State Warriors blew a 3-1 lead in the finals. The Cleveland Indians blew a 3-1 lead in the World Series. The Atlanta Falcons blew a 28-3 lead in the Super Bowl. It goes on. You know, he says this: sports isn't about championship dreams realized in confetti-strewn victory parades. Sports is failure. Sports is devastation. Sports is losing horribly and painfully. Sports is your 2016 Atlanta Falcons, who somehow ended up on the wrong end of a 34-28 overtime defeat in the greatest, saddest Super Bowl ever played. No doubt. I still don't know why, when you were 4 minutes to go and up 8 points and you got the ball on the 22-yard line of the Patriots, give the ball to Freeman, my man. Hand it off. It's like Pete Carroll, give it to beast mode, man. Don't overthink this thing. Not only are you not going to lose ground, but you're going to eat up clock anyway. Enough of that. What's done is done. As he concludes his article, sports is failure, sports is devastation, sports is losing horribly and painfully, but sports isn't usually as horrible and painful as this. A 25-point lead? Come on, Atlanta. No doubt. You know, you can't take anything away from the Patriots, though. Seriously. If you had told me, here's the amazing thing, right? I mean, for the first 35 years of the Super Bowl, there's only been 51. The first 35 years of the Super Bowl, the Patriots had been to the Super Bowl twice and had lost both times. Really weren't competitive in either of them. If you'd have told somebody back in 2001, the New England Patriots are going to win 5 of the next 16 Super Bowls, I would have laughed at you. How has this happened? It's amazing, really. Anyway, when we get back, I want to get back into the Sermon on the Mount a little bit because it's a great Lenten prepper, I believe. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on breadboxmedia.com. Become a friend of your favorite show, including this one. Hint, hint, wink, wink. Just go to breadboxmedia.com and click on friend of the show, and through a monthly contribution, show your support for a show that you believe in. So anyway, those of you out there who are friends of the show, really appreciate your ongoing support. Again, my question of the day, your favorite Garth Brooks song here, 55 years old today. Love to hear from you on that. 573-4BREAD-4, call or text or email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Anyway, we were talking earlier in the show about the Sermon on the Mount, which makes up our Sunday gospel readings starting last Sunday with the Beatitudes. We'll continue on through the last Sunday before we enter into Lent. And believe it or not, Lent begins 3 weeks from tomorrow on Ash Wednesday. So get yourself ready for Lent. And these, I almost wonder if these gospel readings for each of the next several Sundays, including last Sunday's, is not a preparation of sorts, helping us identify perhaps the areas in which we need some more training. Because really that's what Lent is. It's a time of spiritual discipline, training, being conformed more closely to Christ and his sacrifice and what it means to be a disciple. And so we have these series starting this Sunday, these series of instances in which Jesus talks about the law of Moses, which he said himself, he's not come to abolish or to cancel. He's come to fulfill. You've got these series of laws from the Old Testament, and then Jesus deepening and strengthening them, revealing that they're more simply than about external practice, that they are about interior conversion. And we gave an example. You've heard that it was said to your ancestors, you shall not kill. Whoever wills kills will be liable to judgment. But I say to you, kill all you want. No, that's not what Jesus said. But I say to you, whoever is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. He also says, you've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery in his heart. And it goes on from there. There are a number of these things in which we begin to understand the true intent of the law. As I said, not just exterior observance of the bare minimum, but an interior conversion to the maximum. I picked up a book. I'm teaching my class about the Sermon on the Mount right now, and I had them read yesterday a little section from a book I read over 20 years ago called The Jesus I Never Knew by Philip Yancey. Now, Yancey was not a Catholic. He's an evangelical, but with a real Catholic sensibility to him. And, you know, you have to read the book through those eyes. There are parts in there that might rankle a Catholic sensibility. But he's got some very thought-provoking stuff, too. And his idea is to sort of sometimes strip away some of the assumptions we make about Jesus and about his teaching. And so he tells the story here about a friend of his who teaches composition at Texas A&M University, or she did then. Her name was Virginia Stem Owens. And she gave her composition class a copy of the Sermon on the Mount and asked the students to write a short essay in response to it. And this professor had expected them to have a basic respect for the text, since certainly College Station is part of the Bible Belt. But her students' reaction disabused her of that notion. Now, keep in mind, this is over 20 years ago. In my opinion, religion is one big hoax, wrote one. There's an old saying that you shouldn't believe everything you read, and it applies in this case. She said the professor recalled her own introduction to the Sermon on the Mount in Sunday school, where pastel poster illustrations showed Jesus sitting on a green hillside surrounded by eager pink children. Or, you know, as we've seen depicted in film, blessed are the poor in spirit. It said it never occurred to her to react with anger or disgust. Her students thought otherwise. They did not like the essay, Sermon on the Mount. It was hard to read. It made me feel like I had to be perfect, and no one is. Another student wrote, "The things asked in this sermon are absurd. To look at a woman as adultery? That is the most extreme, stupid, and human statement I've ever heard." This professor said, "At this point, I began to be encouraged. There is something exquisitely innocent about not realizing you shouldn't call Jesus stupid. This was the real thing, a pristine response to the gospel, unfiltered through a 2 millennia cultural haze." She said, "I find it strangely heartening that the Bible remains offensive to honest, ignorant ears, just as it was in the first century. For me, that somehow validates its significance." She says, "Whereas the scriptures almost lost their characteristically astringent flavor during the past century, the current widespread biblical illiteracy should catapult us into a situation more nearly approximating that of their original first century audience." In other words, we've so sanitized the Sermon on the Mount and Jesus that we fail to really encounter the offense of his teaching. In fact, Yancey titled this chapter, a message, "A Sermon of Offense." To tell people under the thumb of the Romans, suffering brutality and injustice, to love their enemies? Love your enemies. And what occurred to me is, you know, as Jesus cast this vision, and we'll have to get into this a little bit more tomorrow too, he cast this vision of what this kingdom he's come proclaiming is about. The ethos, the values that so contradict the prevailing values in our culture, that when he comes preaching this, he's just a chapter removed in Matthew's gospel from his temptation, from his 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness, fasting and being approached by the enemy, the tempter, who wants him to choose a different kingdom, a kingdom of indulging his appetites, a kingdom of proving his divine sonship, a kingdom in which he prostrates himself before the devil himself to receive the kingdoms of this world. It's begun to occur to me that there is a correlation here, that Jesus' temptation was about the temptation, too, we all face in the world we live in which these two kingdoms exist side by side. We have this question, this fundamental question of our lives, of which kingdom are we going to embrace? Which kingdom is where we want to take up residence? Which cultural values? The ones that say blessed are the powerful, the strong, the rich, the winners? or that blessed are the poor, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are the meek? Are we going to embrace a kingdom that has sort of a bare minimum morality, or one that seeks an authentic conversion of the heart? This is the fundamental question, and the fact that our Lent is 40 days is meant to parallel the 40 days our Lord experienced as part of his own preparation and training. And so what I would say is, as we head toward Lent, read through the Sermon on the Mount and find those areas that provoke in you the greatest discomfort or the deepest realization that you are not converted to that degree, you and me. And let's say, maybe Lent, maybe this is meant to show us before we enter into Lent precisely where we need work. We'll get about into that a little bit more tomorrow too, because I think that's that is an important question for us as we hint through these very important days in the liturgical calendar. Another thing didn't have time to get into great detail about. I saw last night Katie Couric, a special on the National Geographic channel. I want to watch this because it's prompted by the National Geographic cover on the whole issue of gender issues and gender identity and this increasing awareness, I guess you could say, even mainstreaming of this idea that gender is disassociated with embodiment, and that I think in many ways it's symptomatic of our overall elevation of the therapeutic in our world, in which what I feel cannot be argued with. How do we do it? How do we deal with the compassion and yet also with conviction about certain non-negotiable truths about the human person? We'll have to get into this more tomorrow. Let's go to random.org and dial up our random number generator. And let's see what we spin up between 1 and 2865, total number of paragraphs in the Catechism. Always knowing, of course, that truth is never random, but always integrated within the panoramic totality of the faith. We've come up with 2351. I don't think this is the paragraph that will not be read. Woo! Boy, it's close, though. 2351. Lust is disordered desire for or inordinate enjoyment of sexual pleasure. Sexual pleasure is morally disordered when sought for itself, isolated from its procreative and unitive purposes. This is where it helps us understand Jesus' radical claim that to lust is to commit adultery in the heart. Lust is not simply sexual desire. That's innate, written into our nature. Look at the first reading today from Genesis. Male and female in his image. Sexuality was God's idea. Lust is the disordered desire. It's the desire to take and to use for oneself rather than to give. And as Pope St. John Paul II said, that's love's truest opposite. Because to love is about self-giving. To lust is to take and to use for oneself. Most of us have been around the block to know the difference between loving and using, being loved and being used. We'll be back with you tomorrow by God's grace. Have a great rest of your day. This is The Mike Allen Show.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.